Welcome to Build with Bitcoin. Today's episode features James Levish and David Foley from the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund. They provide their investment thesis as well as the flexibility and advantages that investing in both public and private markets provides. They give us their outlook on the Bitcoin ecosystem, are great thinkers, and have a phenomenal macroeconomics perspective. We hope you enjoy, and as a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only. If you enjoy the content, please remember to follow, subscribe, or share.
Welcome to Build with Bitcoin.
I'm co-host Israel Munoz, along with Lynn Bairstow. Today, we're joined by David Foley and James Levish, managing partners at the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund. We're excited about today's conversation. Thanks for joining, David and James.
Thanks for having us.
Likewise.
Thanks for having us, both of you.
I'm super excited to have you both, David and James. As you know, we started talking. I think I first met you when you were launching the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund. David, you and I met in Naples, and we'd had a number of different conversations because I was just so intrigued by the whole thesis of how you were raising an investment fund and what you were looking to do in the realm of Bitcoin without being a pure venture capital fund. So would love for you to just start us off by just explaining what the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund is. And then we want to dive into a little bit about your Bitcoin origin stories and why you feel it's important. But first, can you give us a high level?
James, you want to start?
Go for it, man. I've already been on a podcast today. It's your turn.
So we are the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund. James and I are the co-managing partners of that fund. It is a public and private investment vehicle in the Bitcoin space. So by that, I mean we invest in public equities, everything from, you know, MicroStrategy to Bitcoin itself to the miners in the space. To also private deals from early stage through kind of mid-stage Bitcoin companies. We'll do later stage. Those are coming, we think, over the next few years. And also our own private mining operations, things like that. We are traditional finance guys by background who, you know, both James and I have been at hedge funds for a number of years and done private equity and public equity and debt investing as well. You know, we both come from arbitrage and distressed debt backgrounds. So we kind of are bringing all that experience to bay here in the Bitcoin space, which we think is both a growth and a value story. You know, Bitcoin is a store of value right now, technology, and increasingly becoming a transactional story as well. And so we're trying to use our experience to manage capital in the space and generate the best risk-adjusted returns for our LPs in the space.
Yeah, the only thing I would probably add to that is one thing that makes us a little bit different than the typical funds that you see, especially in this space, in this nascent cryptocurrency and Bitcoin space, is that being a public and private entity, being a hybrid hedge fund, allows us to look at the opportunity set across the entire space. So it doesn't matter if you're early stage, late stage, public, private, we can and have invested all the way up and down the capital structure, anything from just pure, simple, common equity that's public or private to some preferred equity, or we've invested up in the capital structure into secured debt. Debt that is Bitcoin denominated to remain on a Bitcoin standard for the fund. You know, we have bought assets out of bankruptcy or distressed assets near bankruptcy and use them in mining situations. And so that's something that just makes us different, number one. And the second thing is that because we're a public-private hedge fund, we take the capital, we get it to work immediately, and we start finding opportunities in the public space and through Bitcoin and Bitcoin opportunities while we're looking for those much higher and longer tail private opportunities. And so we're actually getting the money to work while we're looking for those other opportunities. So it's just something that's a little bit different than what you would typically see in the space, which would be a VC that would have capital calls as they find opportunities and trying to get money to work. And so we're not forced to do anything because we have such a large opportunity set that we can just kind of pick and choose, really cherry pick the ones that we see that have the best risk reward.
James, where this is kind of a more familiar investment strategy in traditional finance, to my knowledge, you're the only ones that are doing this specifically focused on the Bitcoin space. Is that accurate?
As far as we know, we're the only ones who are really doing it with this kind of style. I have met some younger guys who are trying to do it, but, you know, and nothing against it. That's just great. And we love having more and more people in the space. There's plenty of opportunity out there, and the space is large enough to handle more of us. But the reality is that, you know, you touched on this early, Lynn, and it is different that David and I come from this traditional hedge fund private equity space, and we've been doing this. I mean, collectively between the two of us, we have over 50 years of experience, just the two of us in this space. And so what's different about that is we understand how to structure these things. We understand how the accounting works, the operations. We understand why it was so important for us to get over to have a GSIB-like the prime broker for us with both RBC and with Fidelity, because we've seen situations where markets have large dysfunction, and we want to be, we want to have our assets custodied by someplace we can trust that doesn't have too much counterparty risk. And so, you know, things like that, things like the accounting, things like the operations, and then quite honestly, just looking at the opportunity sets, being comfortable to do anything in the space, whether it's go into bankruptcy proceedings, and David can talk about that a little bit. When we first started out, that's one of the first things we did, is diving into that space. Or it's negotiating a private situation where we may have more say by joining the board of directors, and then have the ability to actually drive that alpha in that opportunity, because we've seen these things and we've done so many of them. But I'll let David pick up, because if you don't stop me, I'll just talk ad nauseum.
No, I mean, not much to add there. I mean, just, you know, I think James captured it. Just, you know, again, I think one thing I love about this space is just there's so many givers and so much learning. I mean, I can remember, Lynn, first meeting you in Naples and you educating me on stuff like the emerging markets and the use of Bitcoin and dollars versus crypto that's being used down in places like Argentina at that time. And there's no dumb questions, and everyone, you know, and I'm a curious person that can learn from anyone and always has tons of questions. So that's one thing I love. But so, yeah, we've talked to others in the space. I don't think there's a lot that are doing it, but, you know, we're friendly with a lot of these other firms that are venture firms, and we've, collaborated with them on doing some early stage stuff. But I think what we're trying to do is just slightly different. We're trying to also take advantage of both the public and the private markets to be flexible and nimble, and also take advantage of our debt backgrounds. And as James said, distressed, we can go into kind of bankruptcy situations like at Core Scientific, go through that data room, pick apart the assets. Ultimately didn't find anything to do on the private side, but we're able to make money on the public side of Core when it emerged from bankruptcy, given some of our knowledge there. And I think that that's some of the stuff we do. We were able to structure some debt deals where we were able to buy Bitcoin at $25,800, lend that to some public private miners, rather, that pay us back. It's a fully secured loan with tight covenants. And 3 years later, we get paid back in Bitcoin and earn a 10% yield in more Bitcoin while we're waiting. And then we got equity in their company as well. So we're able to kind of take our experience on the debt and the equity side and distressed and kind of, you know, just dig in and try and create interesting opportunities and structures for our investors.
Before we dive even deeper, because I've got questions, I'm sure Israel has questions too about some of the investment approaches that you make. Can you give us your backgrounds, traditional finance, but now you're so knowledgeable about the Bitcoin space. How did you come to be introduced to Bitcoin? What's your origin story in terms of Bitcoin?
Go ahead, Dave.
So yeah, my background is, again, traditional finance. I kind of graduated from Providence College in 95, went to Wall Street, working in investment banking analyst programs. Went back to business school at Harvard after 4 years on as an analyst, and then moved back to Goldman Sachs in New York after that. met a girl who is now my wife and moved back home to Boston where she and I both grew up about 20 years ago. And I joined hedge fund world at that time. So kind of have been in the hedge fund space doing everything from equities to debt. And then in Bitcoin, I was introduced through Larry Lepard, who's my brother-in-law. And Larry and I back in like 2015, 16, I remember debating with Larry saying that Bitcoin was, not gold. It was different. And then in 2017, for a short while, I felt stupid on that. And then when Bitcoin crashed from 17,000 back down to, much lower numbers, I thought, well, maybe I'm right. But boy, I regret that now. I wish I had gone down the rabbit hole a lot sooner. But I think that's the story of everyone in Bitcoin, right? I see it today with a lot of institutional friends of mine that are asking me about it. I just got a call Friday night from one of my old hedge fund colleagues asking me about it. And I can see the skepticism. And I think that's how people have to come about it and learn. But once you do see it and you understand exactly what it is, which to me, probably because of my lens of as a value investor, it's digital gold. It's a scarcest form of money out there, even more scarce than gold, meaning gold has had a value for 5,000 years because its supply grows around 2% per year relative to the U.S. money supply has been growing at like 6.9% a year on average for the last 50 years. And so I think that, people have understood the value of gold, and now Bitcoin, as we know, is even scarcer, right, with capped supply and also the halving cycle. So I think more and more people are understanding the decentralized nature of the network, that no government can ban it, no one controls it. There is no Sam Bankman-Fried risk like there is at every other crypto. And so to pause there, I think most people are seeing, and it took me a few years to see it. And that's kind of my nature, to be skeptical and really dig deep before I see something. And sometimes that's a costly tuition, but ultimately you get there. And that's my background.
Yeah, mine's not too different. Yale undergrad, was going to go play professional hockey, get hurt. And then I'm in New York. And I was wondering what to do. I wasn't sure what to do. And I had a bunch of buddies who were former hockey players or former athletes from Yale. And they kind of pulled me into their world. And they said, well, you need to look at this trading the world, the investment banking trading side of the world. And I didn't really know anything about it, but I was pretty good at math. So I got hired to trade something called ADR arbitrage down on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, which was just taking, as Lynn, you and I have talked about before, but for your listeners, it's just taking foreign securities and creating a basket of them and a security to trade on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, so they could trade in dollars. So, and there's an arbitrage between where they're trading in Europe or in London versus where they're trading here. And we would facilitate orders for our customers through SG Warburg, the British investment bank I was working for. And that was just kind of my foray into this world that actually just led right into working for hedge funds and doing arbitrage, risk arbitrage, convertible arbitrage, distressed debt investing, all of that stuff. And along the way, I got a CFA. I grew up and moved into the portfolio management world. And I've had my own hedge fund. I've worked for hedge funds that are over $5 billion, a family office that was $25 billion when I left. But it was during the pandemic, Lynn, that, I finally turned my attention to Bitcoin. There was a point before that, somewhere around 2018, where, funny enough, it was, I think my 2016 or 2017, my wife had tapped me on the shoulder and she's like, hey, look, I just heard about this thing called Bitcoin. And I think it was on a Tim Ferriss podcast. And I think you ought to check it out. And I was like, honey, look, I'm the math guy. You're an author. You write words. I'll do the math. Don't worry. I'm being facetious, but I was skeptical of it, just like everybody else was. I was like, this thing's used for drugs, is money laundering. No, I'm not going to get involved. I have to take a suitcase down to a parking lot to get a hard drive with, a thumb drive with some code on it. I don't know. Anyway, so I ignored it. Flash forward a couple of years, maybe 2018, and I hear about it again and I'm watching it. It is I think it was about 2018 where it dropped down to $3,500 or something like that from 20,000. And I get, I have an amount of discretionary capital that I'm looking to go out on the risk curve on. I've got some private equity. I've got bonds, stocks, whatever. I'm looking to go out on the risk curve a little bit. And I've heard about this Bitcoin thing. And I'm like, I'm going to go check this out again. And being the good institutional investor I am, I go to the experts in the institutional world who are the tech analysts and the tech portfolio managers. And I go and I ask, and I call them, I talk to them, I sit down with them. I'm like, well, tell me about this Bitcoin thing. And every single one of them, every single one of them said, it has no value. It's a Ponzi scheme. It's used for drug dealers. It's going to go to zero. Don't even get involved in it. Thank God they warded me off because it was only $3,500 back then. And so I ignored it yet again. And so we have a saying here in the Bitcoin world is that everybody gets Bitcoin at their price. And so I missed it at my price. Now you flash forward, it's a pandemic. I've left my firm and I'm trying to figure out what to do. Now, Larry Lepard is kind of the connector here because I know Larry from being in the space. I start talking about institutional investing and I'm meeting some people and I'm watching all of the Michael Saylor videos, and I was orange pilled. I can give you a whole story about that when I was sitting down and watching Jeff Booth on an interview, and everything kind of clicked for me. But it clicked finally that whole the battle between what David was describing before is this ecosystem that's growing, this technology is growing. Why is it so important? Well, there's a battle between the inflationary forces that are central bank monetary manipulation versus the natural deflationary forces of technology and advancement. And those forces are coming together and they're colliding. And so the problem is that the central banks have to print so much money to battle that. And there's no way to actually, as an investor, as a consumer, as someone who's out there expending their energy daily, there's no way to really store that efficiently until now. And that way is Bitcoin. And so you can actually store your value in Bitcoin forever. This is a technology that's been created that has rules, that it's fully decentralized. So it's completely different from all the other things you'll hear about, Ethereum and Solana and all the rest of it. This is fully naturally decentralized. So there's no one person who can change this code. This is what it is. And so I don't want to get too deep into the weeds for your listeners, Lynn, but if you go and look up the Byzantine general's problem, this is what it solves. And so if you do not agree with the vast majority of the other networks and the nodes on the network that a transaction, then that transaction is denied. It fails. And so you're kicked off the network until you come back on with the right chain of transaction. Okay, so I finally get this and it clicks for me. I'm like, oh my God, I've got to get into this Bitcoin. And so I bring my wife in and sit her down. She's like, yeah, this is the thing I was talking about. And so we're watching Jeff. And then at the end of it, and it all just comes together. And she looks at me and she goes, do we own enough? Okay, I'm working on it. So, but anyways, flash forward. Now I've met a bunch of people in the space, and one of those people is Larry Lepard. And Larry, who's partners with David in his hedge fund, said, I need to introduce you to David. I think you two would really get along well. And so we did meet. Soon thereafter, I think it was in Dallas, and we started talking and we realized that there's a tremendous opportunity in this space for people who understand institutional investing, who can actually approach it with that kind of mindset, with a risk reward mindset and understanding how capital allocation works and that long tail investing and the risk reward versus, you know, the opportunity cost of doing other things. So we understand all of this. And so we realize we could bring this to the space and we decide, well, we're going to go out and launch this fund. We can do this. We assembled our general partnership. We've got some people who are excited and we're getting ready to go launch this fund. And I don't know if any of you have watched this show on Hulu recently called The Bear, and it's got a few seasons. I just got onto it recently because I'm older and I'm I'm way behind the curve on this stuff, but there's a point there where it's about, for those who don't know, it's about a chef who's come back to his hometown. He's going to reboot this restaurant. And it's kind of just a dirty old diner. He's going to reboot it into something greater, bigger, like a 5-star, you know, restaurant. And so, and they're doing all this work, and they've gone through all, like, they've assembled everything. They've got the people, they've got the equipment. They're going to do this, and they're soon going to open. They're going to open up like that week or that night. And the sous chef is walking down the street, and as she's walking down the street, it's the middle of the pandemic, and restaurants, the best restaurants in all of Chicago, are closing all around them. And so David and I are sitting there at the precipice of launching this fund, and we're starting to get interest. We're starting to talk to people, and we're getting very excited, and we're like, we're going to do this. And then Celsius happens, and the crypto world just collapses. It looks like it's going to maybe pull through. And then a few months later, FTX happens. And we're talking about, like, that's it. The bottom drops out. It's the worst winter in cryptocurrency that we've seen yet. And we're about to go launch this fund. And that's what it felt like. But we did it. We did get through. We had conversations. Are we doing this? Is this the right time to do this? And absolutely, it was absolutely the right time. There was, cool. Yeah, go ahead, David.
Well, I mean, like, to James's point, we I think every institution that we contacted, like, I won't name them, but one of my old hedge fund colleagues is very senior at some of the largest consulting firms to endowments in the country. And, you know, you just, it was Dr. No. It was, you know, hey, we really, Bitcoin's dead. Crypto died. Sam Bankman-Fried killed it. Those were those type of comments back. And then family offices, it was like really hard too. And then also some people, a lot of the family offices that had dabbled in it were like, well, I just got killed here because we put too much in all these other things in the space. And so it was tough, but we just had to kind of scrap and claw and largely through the high net worth community, as well as a few family offices, we were able to cobble together. And like everything in life, right, there's the opportunity and chaos is the Chinese symbol, right? And so I think that the opportunity was we were able to take advantage of really good, cheap prices in this space with Bitcoin at under 25,000 by the time we launched, and or around 25,000 when we launched. And so, you know, we've been able to take advantage of a lot of good, cheap, you know, I think MicroStrategy was trading down in the low 300s or something like that, maybe 400 or so. And so, you know, it's, you know, for everything, you just kind of keep going. But I think to James's point, I mean, look, this is a real good growth space. And, you know, I often think of the analogy of Paul Krugman, the so-called great Nobel winning economist who called the internet in 97, you know, why do you need it? You have the fax machine. Or Fred Smith, when he was starting UPS at James's alma mater in 1965, he writes his business case study for a class at Yale in 65. And the professor says, well, who the hell would ever need to have something overnight? And, you know, and so he got like a C or a D on the paper. But it's a lot like that, I think, with Bitcoin. And this space is, I mean, I'll give you, for instance, James and I had to move Bitcoin on Friday night. I think we moved, what, James, 300,000 plus USD worth at, what, $1.40, I think?
It costs us a dollar, yeah. And, I mean, and if you're doing that with a wire, I mean, it would take days. And it's a different world, you know. But to David's point, it's important and it's misunderstood. There's a lot of misinformation out there, and the banks have fought against it because of what David just articulated. We can move $300,000 worth in 10 minutes and cost a buck. And so that it eats into the fee income for large banks. We understand that, you know, but that's not really the only, I mean, that's just one aspect of this protocol. And as people are beginning to understand it better, we had a sea change this year with the ETFs being approved. What the ETFs are so important is that these ETFs that are approved are no longer futures, you know, betting based, just cash settled. These ETFs actually own the underlying Bitcoin. And so we're seeing institutions that are getting more and more interested in Bitcoin, and they're buying it. They're putting in their on their balance sheets. They're putting in their portfolios. And so, and that to David and me is wonderful, because it opens this reality that as more investors understand this, and as they allocate it to it as a separate allocation, because they understand that it will soon. It has been highly correlated to the NASDAQ in times of stress. It's a risk on asset. It has been, but as it matures and that correlation breaks and it becomes uncorrelated to everything else in the market, including gold, then it becomes a separate asset class. And we're still early. We're so early. But as that happens, investors are looking for, okay, well, how do I take advantage of that next move? And that's the point of what we're doing, is we're trying to help these companies grow, identify strong opportunities, and raise money around them to grow the ecosystem. And David has actually, you know, he talks about this a lot with the internet, how that
James and David. So maybe you covered a lot of good content there, and I'd like to maybe try and timestamp the maturity of this asset class. I mean, you hit on some great common threads of skepticism that I heard, just to mention a few of the ones I heard from both of your experiences. You know, maybe it's the aha moment comes when someone sees this thing drop, you know, 50, 60, 70%, and then it just kind of eventually just rises back up again. Whether it's, you know, that, or eventually differentiating Bitcoin from crypto and seeing that there's some substance there, or maybe it's the, you know, the pandemic moment where people realized, wow, they really are going to continue just printing a whole lot of money, right? There's a few different moments that people come to start to kind of get a better grasp of this. Where do you think we are in this kind of in the maturity of this asset class? Because there are still lots of points of skepticism, right? And it's hard to understand. You just touched on this as well, James. And it reminded me, sometimes Bitcoin can fall into this kind of dual category, which can be difficult. I mean, I remember when I first started looking into it and studying Bitcoin, I would think, on one hand, it kind of seemed like almost like a venture bet, like an early technology venture bet. But then on the other hand, I would think of it as maybe, you know, a very value, conservative, risk off asset. So there are these you know, these ideas in Bitcoin that people struggle to fully wrap their head around. And maybe that's why we're still so early, right?
Well, I mean, to your point, just the other day, I was with one of my our family friends, and we were talking about Bitcoin. And she's, "Oh, I own Bitcoin. I own Bitcoin." She opened up her phone. She goes, "I own the Ethereum one." So, you know, there's just a lot of misunderstanding. And that she's not stupid. They're just misinformed, you know. And so we're not taught about a lot of this stuff. So let's back way, way, way up. We are not taught about the monetary system, central banking, central bank monetary manipulation. We're not taught about this stuff in high school, in college. Even if you go to get your MBA, and David can speak to this, you're not explicitly taught how this stuff works. You have an understanding generally because it makes sense, but you're not explicitly shown how this works. And so you got to start there. And when I explain to people, so going to your question of how is this maturing, it's taking a lot of time. Why is it taking time? Because of confusion, because the mass media, the traditional media is not incentivized to tell you the truth about Bitcoin. They're incentivized to create controversy. That's just reality. You know, you go to incentives. Dave and I do this all day long. We look for the incentive. What is the incentive? And so there's confusion out there and misunderstanding. But as you understand money and monetary manipulation, and as more people understand this, then they're getting to that point of realizing why Bitcoin is so important and why it's different from all the other protocols that we've discussed, and why it is actually a true store of value, and it will be forever, and it can be built on to have other protocols. But what's important about that is that institutional investors are now on the precipice of getting to that point where they have to really understand this. So when you look at what's going on in the world economically right now and where we are, we're probably on the edge of a recession. We can talk about that if you want, but the reality is something that was so interesting last week is that you have the yen carry trade that blows up. You've got the market that's already topped out and it's coming down. You know, the NASDAQ is already, it's off its highs by 10 to 15% as this carry trade blows up. And then you've got what you would expect this tremendous flight to safety during that time, right? But what did we see? We saw two absolutely abysmal treasury auctions last week. So it makes you think, like, what is going on here? Why were these auctions so weak in a 30-year and a 10-year? The 10-year U.S. Treasury is the reserve asset of the world. How could that possibly have a weak auction during this turmoil of this week? Well, there's one answer. And that answer is that investors are demanding higher yield for later. Why? Why? Because they inherently understand that they're going to get a negative real yield on those investments far out. That's the first point of understanding for traditional and institutional investors to understand why Bitcoin is so important. It's not just gold. Gold is a great inflation, long-term inflation hedge. Bitcoin is tremendously volatile, but it's volatile to the upside as it's being adopted. So that's the important thing. And as investors start to understand this, that's where you get to that point, Israel, that you get more investment in this space. Bitcoin grows as an asset and has enough money in that protocol to actually stomach those moves, because real institutions, big institutions, can now move in and out of it without having massive trading friction, without moving the price tremendously if they try to get out with larger dollars. But I'd be interested also to hear how David frames this, because we talk about this daily.
So I guess the two things I want to talk about: one, Bitcoin is a store of value, and two, then the transactional nature of it and kind of all things Bitcoin, you know, venture backed and things like that. So let's talk on the store of value. Go to MicroStrategy's second quarter earnings call charts that were just produced last week. If you go to MicroStrategy's investor relations page, and Saylor and Shirish have a good slide in the back on basically the $900 trillion in global financial assets, and Saylor shows it as $1 trillion value for Bitcoin. Gold, he's got it $16 trillion, although in our opinion it's more like $6 or $7 trillion, because half of that's in museums and places like the Vatican and antiquities and on women's necks that, or men's necks that's not going to be used. So if you call Bitcoin, gold, and silver as today's sound money, scarce assets where they're not producing much of it, you're less than 1% of global financial assets in the world, $900 trillion in global financial assets. Mm-hmm. As Ray Dalio and Paul Tudor Jones have pointed out, at the end of 79, that inflationary period in America and the world, global financial sound money assets, gold and silver, were about 5 to 7 to 8%, depending on the what your assumptions are, but 5 to 8% of global financial assets. So if we have something like the 70s, you know, I think that, you know, you possibly could see a 5 to 6, 7x in sound money assets, gold, silver, and Bitcoin. And Bitcoin will be the fastest horse in the race, as Tudor Jones says, just given how early we are and how easy it is, as James was saying, to store that value, how anyone in the world with a phone can buy Bitcoin, whereas it's harder to procure gold and silver. So I think that's point one of store value of where we are. And whether you think it's the 70s or something worse, now keep in mind, U.S. debt to GDP was only 35% back in the late 70s. It's pushing well over 100% today, 120% today. And that's a global phenomenon. We've had 50 years of a wonderful party on debt throughout the world. Every central bank, you know, has done this. And so likely this is something more akin to history, you know, financial history of falling of empires and currencies that collapse. Think Weimar Republic, you know, that everyone's familiar with, and even more recently places like Venezuela and Argentina and Turkey and what have you. but Weimer's obviously the big one that, you know, people in the markets talk a lot about. Like, I'm not saying that's going to happen tomorrow, but I'm saying the probability of something like that or something that could smell like that could play out. It probably plays out a little more slowly than that period, but it's in effect, it's playing. So that's just kind of how we think about sizing where this market and asset class could go. There's things like the power law theory that gets criticized a lot, but it's, you know, again, my view is I'm open to any idea out there that people throw out. I think that some of that theory is interesting, although perhaps too conservative, but an interesting power law curve. And then secondly is on the transactional side. You know, I was at the Harvard MIT blockchain conference, and I had lunch with the Bain Capital crypto venture team, one of the guys from that. And I said, you know, I'm just curious, like, what, you know, you're admitting to me that you think Bitcoin is a store of value and the clear winner in that, yet you guys are playing crypto. And he said, well, the reason why there's so much crypto VC is because you can earn a stake, you can earn a yield and get like a 4 to 5 year payback. And I asked the question, I said, but ultimately that's like playing musical chairs. You know that that currency ultimately is built on sand and not on concrete, whereas, you know, Bitcoin is the original. It's the true decentralized. If you want to use corporate, you know, parlance, it's the Coca-Cola, and all these cryptos are Tab and Pepsi and Dr. Pepper and Mountain Dew. They're knockoffs. And the network effects of Coca-Cola that became the global leader, I think, is what will happen in Bitcoin. So I think some of these cryptos will still be here 10 years from now. They don't all die. Some will be interesting technologies, but they're technologies. They're not stores of value. And I think that, you know, it's interesting to me, though, that everyone at this Harvard MIT blockchain, from the students to the VCs, they all see what we see with Bitcoin. I think what James and I see is it's going to be a huge compounder and grower. And then the transactional nature stuff will take over, whether it's MicroStrategy's idea that Michael laid out in Vegas this spring of digital IDs on the blockchain, or the stuff gets developed on these faster chains, as these ventures guys will tell you in crypto. But ultimately, we'll need to come over and touch, you know, the Bitcoin layer two or layer one network. So I'll pause there, so I'm not long-winded, but I think that transactional side is developing and will. I think the store of value thing is right on our doorstep. And it's just a matter of when does global financial chaos start to really kick in, whether it's what we witnessed last Monday playing out much larger scale that then forces the central banks to print money or something else. We feel very good about the store of value story on Bitcoin. Let me pause there.
Yeah. And the one of the things that, David, you were talking about at the beginning of that, which is so important, the underpinning of the technology. This is something that people here in the United States, we're so investment oriented. I mean, we've got the largest investment casino in the world in the NASDAQ, right? So, but people are so focused on number go up. Is this, am I going to make money in this thing? That's a US centric attitude. And that's our point of view. But if you step back and you go to places like Venezuela, Argentina, Lebanon, Egypt, where you have just massive inflation, and you've got those citizens who are holding their currency and doing everything they can to try to get US dollars, but they can't. Dollars are hard to come by in those areas. So what can they do? Well, their currency, their own currency, their own money is devaluing so rapidly that they'll lose 50 to 100%, 50 to 80% in a year. It's just gone. So they can't hold it in their bank account. So when you look at something like Bitcoin, they see Bitcoin and they can get it on their phone. Like, all you need is a phone and an internet connection and you can get Bitcoin anywhere in the world. And so what's important about that is that they can store their money, their energy in that protocol. They don't care that it's volatile, because even if it's up or down 50% over the course of a few months, over the course of 4 years, they know it's going to be higher. Whereas in their own currency, it's volatile to the downside and it's going to zero. And they know that it's going to zero. And so what would you rather do? Would you rather own your own currency, or would you rather own something? It may be volatile, but it will be higher in the next 4 years. If you look at the history of Bitcoin, that's the law. That's the rule. It's been. Okay. The second thing that's really important about it is, for those who are in oppressive areas, We have all seen the photos of these citizens who are fleeing areas, who are trying to get out of these countries, and they've got suitcases of money, or they've got a trunk of gold, and it's seized at the border. Well, if you have Bitcoin, you just have to know your 12 or 24 words, and you walk across, just shirt on your back, you walk across the border, and you've got all of your money still stored all around you. You didn't take it anywhere. It's stored on nodes around the world. So you know that wherever you go, you can access that anywhere in the world, as long as you have an internet connection.
Yeah.
So what's important about it is we've actually know people who have done this. And that's what's important. They've escaped those oppressive areas with all of their wealth because of Bitcoin. These are things that we don't think about in the United States. And that's the organic layer of growth that's happening all over the world right now, especially in places like Northern Africa. So these are things that we don't think about, because all we talk about is, you know, Warren Buffett and investing styles, and should we invest now or reallocate? But the reality of Bitcoin is it's much bigger than that. Yeah. And that's what we often miss here.
I love that you're saying that, James. And I think that's a really important part of the story that does get mixed from traditional investing on Wall Street and whatever. And Israel and I both have roots in Mexico, his original, I'm transplanted roots. But I think that enabled us both. We both came to Bitcoin around 2014, and not just the technology of it, but solving the problems. You talked about moving $300,000 at a cost of a dollar in 10 minutes. And Israel had a startup dealing with remittances early days, because you just see the problems it solves in areas that aren't the U.S. And Mexico is not a country that is that has the level of issues such as Venezuela or Argentina, which luckily looks like it's reversing. But, you know, certainly just the moving of money. And
think about if Carlos Slim wants to, if he wants to transfer, $10 billion. Well, how is he going to do that? We could do it in a bank, but you're dealing with currencies. Like, you could do it with gold. You can move gold. You can actually put gold on a ship and move it somewhere. But with Bitcoin, you can move in 10 minutes for a few dollars.
Yeah. That's right? Why I think the LATAM market, I mean, this is the conversation that we all had. I think LATAM markets understand Bitcoin, and they also understand hedge fund investing, such as the type that you're doing, where crypto might be something that is attractive for the number go up, but when it looks at value, distressed assets, opportunities, the debt side of it, I think this is where, you know, what you're doing has such broad appeal. Israel, I don't know, what's your perspective on that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, it'd also be great to get your opinion, David and James, on, you know, the geographical aspects of this asset class. I mean, I'm not sure what the, you know, LP profile is of the opportunity fund. But where are you seeing both investor interest and the, whether it be public or private markets, the opportunities?
Yeah, I think a couple of thoughts there. Our fund, you know, again, our first fund is closed, and you know, we're being asked about second funds and future funds, and so we're working through it. But we are able to take investors from anywhere over the world. Our first fund has investors from all over the world. Number one, number two, you know, we're seeing kind of opportunities primarily in North America. And some in Europe as well. We have not really focused much in Asia at all. So it's really there. Central America and South America and Latin America, obviously, we're finding and hearing a lot about things, thanks to people like you and Lynn, so who've told us about stuff. And so we're, you know, kind of, I guess so you could kind of say that that's kind of the focal point geographically. I think one of the challenges James and I have is it's just the two of us on fund one. And so there's only so many things we can get to. That's one of our future goals, is to, as we build out the firm further, to be able to build out our team more and scale to look at and take advantage of more opportunities. I think the one thing I'll add on is, I think one future thing that I see is that when we move into this AI technology world more and more, and this stuff doesn't happen in 1 year, I think that's where the public markets are way ahead of themselves. That, you know, just like in 99, we were valuing xyz.com at some crazy number. But, you know, Amazon was down 92% from 99, from 2000 through 02. But that didn't change the fact that Amazon was going to become a bookseller, to become a distributor, to become a technology company with AWS as well. I think that what I think the world will go to is that as more and more of these awakenings happen globally, that global fiat currencies are a problem. And as we're moving back toward pre-1971, pre-Bretton Woods type sounder forms of money, you're going to have this AI technology convergence where you're going to have things like smart contracts and settlement, where Israel and Lynn, you know, maybe we just met each other and we can agree to do a transaction because you can do it better, faster, cheaper than someone else that I've been using here locally. And we can set up this collateral called Bitcoin that you and I both agree is a sound form of money. You will see my wallet. I will see your wallet. We will recognize that that is an escrow. And now we transact. And the contract can be programmable, where at certain 20% of the deal done, you've earned that much of your Bitcoin as settlement. And it's a fair, transparent settlement layer, if you will. And I think that that's ultimately where that goes, where, you know, that was the whole idea. PayPal, when it started, like Peter Thiel's talked about this, that the goal was to have internet money, like something outside of JP Morgan and Bank of America controlling between 9 to 5 Monday through Friday, but you're not able to touch it. And they take massive fees, and then they take your money and they lend it on to someone, fractional reserve banking, and God knows what risks they're taking. We've seen that. Go look at JP Morgan's derivatives book sometime on their footnotes, and you'll say, okay, these are, as Warren Buffett says, the derivatives are the nuclear weapons on Wall Street nowadays. And look, I mean, the banks are probably in better shape than they were in 08, but there's risk out there. Eventually, you're going to be in this self-sovereign world where people are back to saving and storing their own value, being the bank on their own phone. You know, my 16-year-old daughter, I'm really proud of her. She worked hard this summer setting up her own summer camp for 19 kids and banked a lot of cash, you know, because she's learned economies of scale. You don't babysit one kid, you babysit 19 and you scale it. And so I told her, she said, well, Dad, I get this money and I just got my driver's license. Well, what do I do? And I said, well, you're going to learn about Cash App. You're going to learn about being your own self-sovereign bank where you can flip between Bitcoin and cash as you need it. The way in 1995, when I showed up for my first job, I would move all my money into my savings account to earn 5% savings and then go to the ATM. There was no online banking then. Go to the ATM and move $300 over to go pay your utility bills or your rent that end of the month into your checking account at the ATM and then write your check by hand. That's what we're going to be doing on things like Cash App, where it's going to be your own bank and it's going to be you being able to save in Bitcoin and then move it to dollars. And the world will get ubiquitous at this, like my daughter's learning. And it's not that complicated for those young people to learn that and adapt it. It's a little harder for our, you know, people my age, 50 plus. But I'll pause. I've been long-winded. But I think that's coming. I think macroeconomics will drive that. I think the technology will drive it. Everyone forgets that, you know, e-commerce took time for Amazon to develop, but then you had fiber build out, you had the iPhone and the iPad in the early 2000s, and then you had just various things that changed over time that made it easier to do e-commerce. And I think that's how this will play out over the next decade in this space. So let me pause there.
James, I'd like to ask you a tactical question. So when you're talking to your investor clients, how do you recommend that they, looking at portfolio allocation, what should people be considering as a percentage of their portfolio into Bitcoin or something like your fund in order to get exposure to this opportunity that, I mean, you guys are just so brilliantly sharing?
It's a good question, Lynn. What we tell investors is first understand it. Please understand Bitcoin. And once you do, and then they will invariably, understanding it, want to have a core holding in their own portfolio. It's different for every single person. You know, it depends on what are you an individual? Are you a high net worth individual? Are you part of a family office? Do you have long-term plans? Do you have a steady flow of income? Like what kind of asset mix do you already have So that's hard for me to answer, like what percentage anybody should have. But if you don't have a few percent of Bitcoin, I would say that that's probably a mistake if you don't have a few percent at least. How much that is, it really depends. I mean, for my son, who's, 24 years old, he could have virtually all of his capital invested in these technologies, but he's got a very, very, very long timeline and time horizon. So it really depends. So that's number one. What we have found, Lynn, is that our first fund, our investor mix there is by and large high net worth individuals who have their own allocation of Bitcoin already, and they're looking to build on that. And I'll let David talk about that part. But now what we're finding in this, now that the dust has settled from FTX and Celsius and that crypto winter, and we've put the vast majority of that the illegal nefarious activity behind us, now we're seeing that with the ETFs being introduced, with more institutions getting involved, with Bitcoin getting a little bit different coverage, especially as you have Fidelity and BlackRock talking about it, Bitwise talking about it almost daily, that this has changed the landscape a little bit and people are approaching it differently. So this now what we're seeing is we're getting a lot more interest from family offices who are like, hey, I think our family office needs some allocation to this beyond just a little bit of Bitcoin. Tell us about what you guys are doing. And so that's been the new conversation for us. And that's how it's kind of evolving so far.
Yeah, I think a lot of our LPs, and we see it too, that, you got to kind of build your future that you want to see, and that, and I think that all these companies building it out, building these on-ramps, building these technologies, are going to bring more and more people to this ecosystem, which will then therefore grow the asset class. So I'd say that's part one, that many of our LPs and us.
Yeah, if you go back to 1998, 1999, right?
Right. And same thing, right? Exactly. Building out internet related businesses and that. And I think that, that's point one. And I think point two, people see the value of diversification, rather than just having it all tied up in Bitcoin, that there are some companies that will possibly outperform. If you can get lucky and catch lightning in a bottle of some really great business that changes the world, you can really outperform. Look at, again, go back to Michael Saylor's charts. I think he had it in the Q2 call last week, or it was the national conference, or maybe he posted on Twitter. But, there are like a handful of companies that have outperformed Bitcoin itself over the last, 4 years, NVIDIA, MicroStrategy, Supermicro, and then there's a bunch of others that have kept up, And so, personally, I think, Bitcoin is going to probably be one of the best performing asset classes over the next decade, compounding it well north of 25%, and that's probably conservative. And I think that maybe there'll be a few other companies that do that. But in this space, it's so early that this is truly like early stage venture investing at every level, even on companies that are doing their Series B round that we've invested in. These things are still early. And so the asymmetry of the upside is phenomenal. And so to finish the point, I think a lot of people see the benefit of that, of also just diversifying their assets.
Yeah, and Lynn and I certainly share that view that a lot of companies will emerge from that. I mean, that's why we started, Build with Bitcoin itself, right? We see, and you hit on this a little earlier, David, but I mean, if you stomach the volatility, it's a great store of value. If you get past the poor UX and usability side of it, it's actually a really great transactional currency. So really, I mean, the pain points are just the usability and the applications, right?
But those are the opportunities, and that's where we're seeing a lot of opportunities.
Precisely, exactly. And that's what entrepreneurs do, right? They solve pain points. So I mean, when you take that with those trends and kind of project it forward, it's a big market.
It's 1995 and it's AOL and dial-up modems are the winners right now. And the newspaper companies like the New York Times are making money on this thing called the internet, selling advertisements. And you haven't really heard of Amazon.com quite yet, or it's kind of emerging, I guess, at that point as a book distributor, and you haven't really heard of Google yet. I'll never forget starting business school, and I'm like using Yahoo as a search engine, and the librarian says to me, you should look at this thing called Google. And it's like, whoa, like, I wish I'd kept her in mind when the IPO happened about 4 years later, 3 years later, and actually bought a hell of a lot more of it. But I think that, that's exactly where we're at. And it's just going to take time to play out. I think that's also the danger in this space, right? You can't just chuck all sorts of money at every startup and think like, okay, they're just going to burn through capital and they'll just be able to keep raising. Like, no, you saw that last year that it gets hard. There are cycles to credit cycles apply in this space too. And I think that you got to find teams that really know how to husband capital and manage burn and really allocate capital well. There are capital allocators too. They're no different than we are. And so that's something that we're very keen on is trying to find companies that can make cash flow sooner rather than later. So we've got, you know, some property and casualty insurance type businesses that, you know, the economics of insurer are beautiful, right, when it scales. And so the chance to earn free cash flow there, we've back to, you know, the main Intel inside semiconductor like business for the Core Scientific block mining ASIC deal. These are all businesses that we think can really scale rapidly and scale cash flow rapidly. And so that's just something we're at.
You know, that's a fascinating point that Israel and I are really tuning into with a lot of the companies that we speak to on the podcast, is that this whole concept of growth at all cost, scale, just raise as much money as you can, is totally flipped in the Bitcoin ecosystem, because the hurdle rate is Bitcoin. And so we find companies much more conservative in their deployment of capital, much more thoughtful about how they retain their earnings, and much of it being put into Bitcoin itself, like MicroStrategy on their treasury. But now you're starting to see Fold app, which is going public, you know, has announced that their treasury is in large part in Bitcoin. Strike over the, the last week, Mallers came out and was talking about his Bitcoin treasury. How do you see Bitcoin startups that you're investing in or that you're looking at as being different than what we consider the high-flying tech companies that are traditional VCs are looking at?
Yeah, that's a good question. We're at a stage here where there should be tremendous growth, and we're seeing the starts of that. But remember, we're coming out of the ashes of a very difficult period in this space. And so actually what David and I have been working on mostly is pouring through opportunities and fundings on the private side for companies that have struggled to raise capital, and that they did raise capital at very high valuations early, and now they're looking to raise capital again at much different valuations. And so that's kind of the stage. If you think about the stage that we're in for these companies, that's something that's a little bit different than 1999, because what is really interesting about this is that we've had this wipeout before we even had this tremendous growth, really, you know, $1 trillion of assets in the ecosystem. Well, now you've got multiple trillion, but that's what kind of sets us apart from that early 1997, 1998 conversation.
And I think just all that, when I add on, is, yeah, I think a lot of entrepreneurs learned, you know, in this space from the last 2 years of, boy, you got to be careful, because the well can go dry quickly, and you can't kind of overhire too fast. You gotta manage the whole runway. So, it's not dissimilar to the late 90s internet lessons. But I think you're right. I think a Bitcoin standard and holding yourself to that, having a high hurdle rate, it does provide some discipline.
Yeah, we certainly have seen that, like Lynn mentioned, in some of the startup founders that we've had on the podcast. I mean, very different business models, but all of them, what they share is precisely that kind of bootstrap, smart use of resources mindset, right? Which allows them to build a profitable business at an earlier stage than maybe, you know, a high growth, just keep fundraising type of startup?
Well, we're at an hour. We're kind of reached our time. I could keep talking. I have a lot more questions. So we'd love to get you on again at some point in the future. As we start to wrap it up, we'd just love for you guys to just talk about any calls to action or next steps. One thing I do want to call out is James's weekly newsletter called The Informationist, which I religiously read and is fantastic on macro topics and just the overview. We're going to put all this in the show notes, but anything in particular that you'd like to draw people's attention to?
No, I mean, we appreciate everybody who reaches out. Sometimes we can't get to them quickly because Dave and I are you know, the ones in the trenches doing most of the work every day. And so, but if, you know, if you're a company or if you know of a company that is in the Bitcoin space and interested, or if you want to have some information about what we're working on at the fund, at the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund, we will have a second fund. From the looks of it, sooner likelier than later, because of the interest we're getting and because of the opportunity set we're seeing. If we see an opportunity set that's large enough to not just warrant another fund, but to actually augment our first fund because it allows us to participate in larger deals, then we'll do that. And so if you want more information and you are a high net worth investor, an accredited investor, or a family office, then you can reach us at James or David at bitcoinopportunity.fund. And so, but we're happy to talk to you.
Same. Yeah, I think James captured it all.
We really appreciate having you guys on. It's definitely a very fresh and different perspective to some of the other, you know, episodes that we've had. So you bring some very valuable macro and, you know, risk management perspectives to this nascent asset class. And, you know, we appreciate the time for coming on.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, we'll look forward to the next time. Always good to see you, Lynn, and thank you, Israel.